This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I want to welcome everyone to Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. How many people are here for the first time in our space? Welcome to all of you. Thanks for coming out tonight to see Stephen. Stephen Batchelor is on a very short list in my mind of Buddhist teachers who I really want to spend time with. And I mean that. There was a time when sort of any Buddhist teacher I wanted to spend time with them. Not so anymore. Dalai Lama comes to town, I'm kind of like, somebody gives me tickets, maybe. Stephen Batchelor, I will travel. And I mean that in a sincere way because I've been inspired and learned so much from his writing and from the little bit of time I've had the opportunity of spending time with him. I'm about halfway through this new book and really enjoying it. I love to hear people's personal, direct life stories. I learn a lot from that, and I'm learning a lot from these confessions of our Buddhist atheist. So, Stephen, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Noah. And thank you, everyone at Against the Stream, who's made this event possible. I'd like to begin with a period of about 15 minutes of just sitting quietly. You can call that meditation if you like. For those of you who don't, who are not used to doing meditation, although that's something I find to be quite rare these days, meditation having become very much part of not only Buddhism, but of our contemporary culture in some ways. So I'd suggest that we find a comfortable posture with our back comfortably upright so that we can breathe freely and deeply, and then just letting the breath settle into its own natural rhythm, not in any way trying to control or to manipulate the breathing, but just to come to rest in that natural primal pulse or rhythm of life itself, our primary relationship with our environment and our world and with others. And if the mind gets distracted, which it tends to, then gently return to the rhythm and the sensation of breathing and come once again to focus attention there. It's a strange business writing a book. Some of you may know what I mean. As I was sitting here, I was, for some reason, an image came to mind of a boa constrictor, a great big snake that has eaten a large animal of some kind, and the large animal is creating this great distended a shape in the belly of the snake, and it's going to spend, sometimes I've read, several weeks before it has digested its meal. And I feel somehow having, when I on completion of this book, a bit like that. I know that sounds a bit odd, perhaps, but this is the first book I can remember having written when, having reached the end of the writing process, I felt that I couldn't somehow wrap my mind around the whole thing. There was somehow too much of it. And I couldn't gain the sort of distance to be able to contemplate the book as a completed work, as though I still needed a lot of digestion to do to get a handle on it. It also meant that I was quite unable to form any kind of critical value judgment as to whether it was any good or not. My editor seemed to like it, but then it was in her interest to like it, at least by that stage of the process. It was also a book that I had written, especially in the second draft, much faster than I normally write. I was under quite tight deadline pressure if I were to get it out in order that I could be here in March, which I'd already arranged. These are the realities of an author's life, I'm afraid. Don't think that I sit in this idyllic French village just writing when I feel like it. No, one is under all sorts of contractual and other pressures as well. And it's still, I feel, something that I can't quite get hold of. One reason, I think, is because there are a number of different threads, narrative threads, that run through this book. It's a lot of material, some of which one might not at first sight think would go particularly well together. There's the story of my own life, my own Buddhist life, which entails going back to my childhood, my leaving home at the age of 18, travelling to India, meeting the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans in Dharamsala in the early 70s, my training as a monk in the Tibetan tradition, the Zen tradition, and then after 10 years of that, becoming a lay person again at the age of 32, I think it was, and returning to a community in southwest England where I worked as a writer, as a teacher in the local Vipassana community, and began to travel further afield to teach, help set up community retreat center, and quite involved in the local community for about 15 years, and then in the year 2000 left for France, where my wife and I had bought a house, to live a rather more solitary existence, but at the same time thereby able to accept invitations to go further afield. And it was during this period that I began to become fascinated by the Buddha's life. And much of the latter part of this book is my reconstruction of the life of the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama. So in other words, my own life then begins to get interwoven with the story of the Buddha's life. And I explain in the book, so I'm not going to go into this now, what it was that somehow opened my eyes to look at this person, the Buddha, in a very different light. Like most Buddhists, I had taken on the default view that the Buddha was a prince who grew up in a palace, and then one day, getting a bit bored with having such a good time, he decided to go outside the city walls and see what went on in the world out there. He meets a sick person, an aging person, he sees a corpse, he sees a wandering monk, and on each occasion he says, "Oh my God, is this going to happen to me?" Charioteer says, "Oh yes." And so his whole perspective on what life is about is given this existential shock, and that prompts him to become a renunciant, a mendicant, in search of awakening, enlightenment. And then after 6 years of arduous practice, he sits beneath a tree and becomes the Buddha. After which he teaches for 45 years, establishes his community, his doctrine, and then he dies in Kusinara. The problem with that story is that it is largely mythical. The events described, particularly the palace, the prince, the renunciation, the palace walls, none of that is found in the earliest texts. It's a later construction of a narrative that reflects a different historic period in India and is largely designed for inspiration. And it is inspiring. I don't want to dismiss it as a myth, but the problem is Buddhist traditions have tended to take this myth as though it were some sort of historical account, some sort of biography, but it's not. And what is also, I think, strange is that we know very little, or most Buddhists have very little understanding of what happened from the Enlightenment until his death, which is 45 years, is a long time, and what he had to do in order to achieve his goals of establishing the Dharma, his teaching, and the Sangha, his community. And to do that, he had to interact with the powerful figures of his day. The kings, his family members were always getting in the way. And he was very much a player in the social and political environment of his time. And it was only when I went to India with my friend Alan Hunt Bedina in 2003 to take photographs of the historic Buddhist sites on the pilgrimage route. Some of you have been with me on these trips, that I started to get a sense of the Buddha's geography and a sense of the distances he covered and a sense of the physical landscape in which he lived and breathed as a human person. And as I began to excavate in the Pali Canon for more historical details, I found numerous fragments, chronologically chaotic, scattered all over the text. But by pulling them apart, by extracting them, was able to come up with, I think, a very different but rather compelling portrait of this man living in that time in Indian history and achieving his goals of establishing the Dharma and the Sangha. But what is perhaps surprising is that his at the end of his life did not end in triumph, but it ended in tragedy. There is the last years of the Buddha's life I compare to a passio, the passion of Christ. This is the passion of the Buddha. Now, to explain what I mean by that would take too long, so I'm afraid you'll have to read the book. Now, what I'd like to do this evening is, now I sort of sketch what the book covers, I'll touch on some of these points again, and of course, at the end, if you have questions, you can raise them, and I'll try and answer as best I can. But I just want to start by giving a taste, really, of my journey to India as a young man in 1972. I was a product of the hippie culture, the counterculture of the 1960s, and it was that that, in a way, was the impetus for pretty much all of my colleagues and peers in the Buddhist teaching world to take the risk of abandoning a university, a career, a security, and heading off to India or Japan or Korea and dedicating ourselves to the study and the practice of Buddhism, which at the time was considered to be a kind of strange thing to want to do. There didn't seem to be any future in it. And of course, one of the great confirmations, of that choice, is the fact that this is here today. And one shouldn't forget that. But in 1972, if I wanted to study Buddhism in the West, there was nowhere to go. There were no Buddhist monasteries. There were hardly any centers at all. Hardly any teachers. Certainly, nothing like Tricycle magazine, and really just sort of, mimeographed newsletters of little Buddhist groups. That was it. Hardly any books. You could have read in 1972 every Dharma book on the market with very little difficulty. There's probably only a couple of dozen of them. Now, you can't even keep up with the number of books that are published each month. And I'm not exaggerating. If someone had told me in the early 1970s, in 30 years' time, there will be Dharma centers all over the Western world, there will be Buddhist publishing houses. Mindfulness will be taught in healthcare. The Dalai Lama will be an international religious figure, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. I would have regarded that person as a fantasist. It simply would not, if that sort of picture would not really have even crossed our minds as being possible, except in our most idealistic moments, perhaps. So what I describe in this book is, in a sense, a story of how what started out as a few hippies going off to India has now helped, or has been, a catalyst in the emergence of a Buddhist culture in the West, which continues to grow, which continues to sort of expand and develop. And that's, for me, a very, very moving affirmation of those initial risks that many of us took. This is from chapter... I'll just read the opening section of chapter 2, which is called On the Road. From the monk's cell, hewn out of the sandstone cliff centuries earlier, where I spent my days idly smoking a potent blend of marijuana, hashish and tobacco, a narrow passage led to a dark inner staircase that I would illuminate by striking matches. The steep rock steps climbed to an opening that brought me out via a narrow ledge onto the smooth dome of the giant Buddha's head, which fell away dizzily on all sides to the ground 180 feet below. On the ceiling of the niche above were faded fragments of painted Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I feared looking up at them for too long, lest I lose my balance, slip, and plummet earthward. As my eyes became used to the fierce sunlight, I would gaze out onto the fertile valley of Bamiyan, a patchwork of fields interspersed with low, flat-roofed farmhouses which lay stretched before me. It was the summer of 1972. This was my first encounter with the remains of a Buddhist civilization, one that had ended with Mahmud of Ghazni's conquest of Afghanistan in the 11th century. Now, these were the Buddhas that were blown up by the Taliban in 2001. Like others on the hippie trail to India, I thought of myself as a traveller rather than a mere tourist, someone on an indeterminate quest rather than a journey with a prescribed beginning and end. Had I been asked what I was seeking, I doubt my answer would have been very coherent. I had no destination, either of the geographical or spiritual kind. I was simply on the road, in that anarchic and ecstatic sense celebrated by Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and other role models I revered at the time. I enjoyed nothing more than simply being on the way to somewhere else. I was quite content to peer for hours through the grimy, grease-smeared windows of a rattling bus with cooped chickens in the aisle, observing farmers bent over as they toiled in fields, women carrying babies on their backs, barefoot children playing in the dust, old men seated in the shade smoking hookahs, and all the shabby little towns and villages at which we stopped for sweet tea and unleavened bread. Yet as soon as we entered the telltale suburban sprawl of the city of our destination, my stomach would contract, and I would feel anxious and restless again. I did not want to stop. My craving to keep moving was like an addiction. And so on. So I'm not going to go into any more of that stuff. I thought it appropriate today, since we are at a centre called Against the Stream, to read from a chapter of this book which is called Against the Stream. So I can talk about what Against the Stream means in Against the Stream from Against the Stream. What could be more appropriate than that? Now I start by, in this chapter, by describing a trip I made to India in 2003 when I travelled to all the Buddhist pilgrimage sites, and that serves as a that travelogue runs through the text also. It's another one of the threads, and it serves to present India today as a pilgrim, and then I flash back to 2,500 years before to tell the Buddha's story. So I'll just read the first paragraph of the chapter and then I'll cut to the rest. On extricating ourselves from the dilapidated streets of Gaya, Mr. Khan, my driver, and I joined the road that runs beside the great sandy riverbed of the Neranjara River into Bodhgaya, the present name of Uruvela, the site of Siddhartha Gautama's awakening. We wind our way into an acquisitive pilgrimage town that is bustling, noisy, and polluted and spreads for miles. A jet roars overhead, delivering pilgrims direct from either Colombo or Bangkok to the local airport. Luxury hotels compete with shabby guest houses. Temples of every Buddhist hue can be glimpsed behind high walls and through wrought iron gates. Monks, nuns, and lay pilgrims from all over Asia, as well as Westerners sporting telltale Buddhist insignia, throng the streets, trailed by beggars, lepers, and cripples rattling coins in tin cans. And at the far edge of this conurbation, fields have already given way to yet more building sites. Buddhism is booming in this little pocket of Bihar. Then I flash back to a time I was there in 1974 when Bodh Gaya was just a sleepy Indian village. I am glad I belong to a religion that worships a tree. The magnificent Pipal, whose outspread branches offer shade to those who walk below on white marble flagstones as they circumambulate the Mahabodhi temple, is indifferent to the pilgrimage industry that has surged around it in recent years. It does not mind that its great trunk is wrapped with garish satin cloths, that its limbs are strung with prayer flags, or its fallen leaves collected by the children of the devout. This tree, a distant descendant of the one beneath which Gautama sat, has seen many tides of human beings come and go. Hindu priests, who used the adjoining temple as a shrine to Shiva, archaeologists of the Raj, who rediscovered the temple in the 19th century, Anagarika Dhammapala, the Ceylonese reformer who vowed to return the tree, temple, and surrounding monuments to Buddhist control, the thousands of Tibetans who fled with the Dalai Lama across the mountains in 1959, the millions of Indian ex-untouchables who have recently embraced Buddhism to escape the indignity of caste, as well as occasional pale-faced converts like myself. This Dhamma I have reached, said Gautama, in describing what he discovered that night under the branches of the original tree, is deep, hard to see, difficult to awaken to, quiet and excellent, not confined by thought, subtle, sensed by the wise. But people love their place. They delight and revel in their place. It is hard for people who love delight and revel in their place to see this ground, this conditionality, conditioned arising. This is the account of a man who set out on a journey and reached his destination. What he found there was deeply strange and unfamiliar, difficult to conceptualize or put into words. At the same time, he realized that others must have experienced it too. For what he had woken up to, this conditionality, this hyphen conditionality, idapachayata, that specific things give rise to other specific things, was, in one sense, rather obvious. Everyone knows that seeds give rise to plants and eggs give rise to chickens. Yet, he insisted, this conditioned arising is extremely hard to see. Why? Because people are blinded to the fundamental contingents of their existence by attachment to their place. One's place is that to which one is most strongly bound. It is the foundation on which the entire edifice of one's identity is built. It is formed through identification with a physical location and social position, by one's religious and political beliefs, through that instinctive conviction of being a solitary ego. One's place is where one stands, and whence one takes a stand against everything that seems to challenge what is mine. This stance is your posture vis-à-vis the world. It encompasses everything that lies on this side of the line that separates you from me. Delight in it creates a sense of being fixed and secure in the midst of an existence that is anything but fixed and secure. Loss of it, one fears, would mean that everything one cherishes would be overwhelmed by chaos, meaninglessness, or madness. Gautama's quest led him to abandon everything to do with his place, his king, his homeland, his social standing, his position in the family, his beliefs, his conviction of being a self in charge of a body and mind, but it did not result in psychotic collapse. For in relinquishing his place, alia, he arrived at a ground, tana. But this ground is quite unlike the seemingly solid ground of a place. It is the contingent, transient, ambiguous, unpredictable, fascinating, and terrifying ground called life. Life is a groundless ground. No sooner does it appear than it disappears, only to renew itself, then immediately break up and vanish again. It pours forth endlessly, like the river of Heraclitus, into which one cannot step twice. If you try to grasp it, it slips away between your fingers. This groundless ground is not the absence of support. It supports you in a different way. Whereas a place can tie you down and close you off, this ground lets you go and opens you up. It does not stand still for a moment. To be supported by it, you have to be with it in a different way. Instead of standing firmly on your feet and holding on tight with both hands in order to feel secure in your place, here you have to dart across its liquid shimmering surface like a long-legged fly, swim with its current like a fast-moving fish. Gautama compared the experience to entering a stream. The heart of Gautama's awakening lay in his unequivocal embrace of contingency. One who sees conditioned arising, he said, sees the Dhamma. And one who sees the Dhamma sees conditioned arising. He recognized how both he and the world in which he lived were fluid, contingent events that sprang from other fluid, contingent events. But that need not have happened. Had he made other choices, things would have turned out differently. Let be the past, he said to the wanderer Udayin. Let be the future. I shall teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. Siddhartha Gautama rejected the idea that freedom or salvation lay in gaining privileged access to an eternal, non-contingent source or ground, whether it be called Atman or God, pure consciousness or the Absolute. Freedom, for Gautama, meant freedom from greed, from hatred, and from confusion. Moreover, such freedom, nirvana, was to be found not by turning away from the world, but by penetrating deep into its contingent heart. The Brahmins of Gautama's day, the priests, maintained that a human being was animated by an eternal soul or self, Atman, whose nature was identical to the transcendent, perfect reality of Brahman or God. This belief is deeply alluring because it means that what we really are will not die. And it is compelling because it appears to be confirmed by that deeply embedded intuition of being an unchanging witness to the flux of moment-to-moment experience. The sight of a flock of starlings swooping through the sky, the taste of a peach, or the melody of Bach's Sixth Brandenburg Concerto may come and go, but the sense of being the one who knows these things remains the same. From my earliest childhood until now, I have been intuitively convinced that the very same consciousness has witnessed and continues to witness every event in my life. If I look at a photograph of myself as a baby, or consider how I have grown up and changed over the years, I realize that this timeless witness cannot be the same as the puzzled little boy, the rebellious adolescent, the devout young monk, or the skeptical middle-aged man. All these aspects of myself, it seems, are just different manifestations of my ego or personality, but have nothing to do with the essential, unchanging self who knows and remembers these things. At the same time, one of the most unsettling memories of my youth is of an occasion when my mother inadvertently challenged my instinctive certainty of being me. It was Christmas, and I must have been about 16. My mother and her sister, my Aunt Betty, were leafing through a volume of photographs on the kitchen table. They came to a snapshot of a man in military fatigues, eyes squinting against the desert sun, pipe clenched between teeth. My mother said to me, "If things had worked out differently, he would have been your father. I thought, but if that man had been my father, would I have been me? This led me to wonder. If another of my actual fathers, myriad spermatozoa, had impregnated my mother's ovum, would the child born from such a mingling of chromosomes have been me? Or had the same spermatozoan burrowed home in her next ovarian cycle, would that baby have been me? Despite such unnerving glimpses of my own contingency, the conviction of being a permanent, timeless witness has remained as steady and self-evident to me as the view I have of the sun rising every morning in the east, crossing the sky, then setting in the west. I seem to be hardwired to experience myself and the world in this way. Yet despite the undeniable evidence of my own eyes, I know that the earth sets and rises, not the sun. Gautama did for the self what Copernicus did for the earth. He put it in its rightful place, despite its continuing to appear just as it did before. Gautama no more rejected the existence of the self than Copernicus rejected the existence of the earth. Instead, rather than regarding it as a fixed, non-contingent point around which everything else turned, he recognized that each self was a fluid, contingent process just like everything else. Gautama declared that his awakening to the contingent ground of life went against the stream. It was counterintuitive. It went against the instinctive sense of being a timeless witness of one's experience. It contradicted the belief in an eternal soul and, by implication, in the transcendent reality of God. Rather than disassociating oneself from the world in order to achieve union with God, Gautama encouraged his followers to pay close, penetrating attention to the rise and fall of the phenomenal world itself. The way in which he presented the practice of meditation turned the received wisdom of the day on its head. Instead of instructing his students to turn their attention inward to contemplate the nature of their soul, he told them to be acutely aware of their bodies, to be calmly mindful of whatever was impacting one's senses in that very moment, noticing its emergence and disappearance, its ephemerality, its impersonality, its joy, and its tragedy, its allure, its terror. The metaphors he used to describe the practice of mindfulness are earthy and practical. He compared the meditator to a skilled wood turner and butcher, men who have learned to use their tools with extraordinary precision, who can shape a piece of wood or dissect a carcass with minimal effort and maximum efficiency. Mindful awareness is not presented as a passive concentration on a single steady object, but as a refined engagement with a shifting, complex world. Mindfulness is a skill that can be developed. It is a choice, an act, a response that springs from a quiet but curious intelligence. And it is empathetic, keenly sensitized to the peculiar texture of one's own and others' suffering. Siddhartha Gautama was a dissenter, a radical, an iconoclast. He wanted nothing to do with the priestly religion of the Brahmins. He dismissed its theology as unintelligible, its rituals as pointless, and the social structure it legitimated as unjust. Yet he fully understood its visceral appeal, its addictive hold on the human heart and mind. He refused to play the role of an enlightened guru who demanded uncritical submission before initiating his disciples into doctrines reserved for the spiritual elite. Yet he could not remain silent. There came a point when he had to act. He realized that there must be some people, those with little dust on their eyes, who would understand him. So he left his tree in Uruvela and went to Varanasi, where he knew that some of his former companions, a group of five Brahmins from Sakya, were staying in a deer park near the village of Isipatan. Now I'm going to jump to the last chapter, called A Secular Buddhist, and this is in fact close to the title I gave for this presentation, which was Reflections on Secular Buddhism. I'm using the word secular, by the way, not in the sense of non-religious, although it might have that connotation, but in its more literal sense, from the Latin word seculum, from where the English secular comes. Seculum means this time or this age. In other words, a secular Buddhist is one who is concerned with the suffering of this time and this age and this world. A secularist is one whose entire concern and energy and passion are to do with this world, not with a world that may or may not happen after death. A this-worldly approach to the Dhamma. Now, of course, this gets me into a lot of trouble, because Buddhism traditionally, of course, would even say the opposite. When I was studying as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, I remember memorizing a verse that began, Sedi la shena chabanin, which means, if you are concerned with this life, you are not a practitioner of the Dhamma. Sedi la shena chabanin. And it's only when you embrace the grand vision of a multi-life view that you, as it were, begin to practice the Dhamma. So much of this book is about my own struggle to understand the Buddha's teaching in terms of what it means here and now. If there is a future life, and there might be, I don't know, I can think of no better way to prepare for it than to live authentically and fully and wisely and compassionately with total commitment to responding to the suffering of this world. And if there's no future life, I've done the best I can. In other words, it's a win-win situation. This chapter starts with a reflection on my own story again. In 1996, I discovered the internet. I was working at Sharpham, which was the community in which I lived in England, as the director of the newly founded Sharpham College for Buddhist Studies and Contemporary Inquiry. It was a very short-lived endeavor, which had just started running a year-long residential program for up to 12 students. One of the students had previously worked in the computer industry and showed me how to use the internet as a research tool. Out of curiosity, I typed in the name of my great-uncle, Leonard Krask, the black sheep of our family, who had abandoned his wife and a career in medicine to pursue his vocation as an actor and artist in the United States, about whom during my childhood I knew nothing. He was persona non grata in conversation. The search produced a number of references, most of which were connected to a statue of a fisherman located on the shorefront of the city of Gloucester, Massachusetts. The man at the wheel, as it is known, turned out to be Leonard's most famous work of sculpture. Commissioned by the city of Gloucester to commemorate the 300th anniversary of the founding of the city in 1623, the bronze statue was unveiled to the public and dedicated on August the 23rd, 1925. It depicts a 10-foot-high fishermman in oilskins gripping the wheel of his boat as he steers it through a North Atlantic storm. Yet to my Buddhist eyes, this monument commemorating heroic American individualism showed a man holding an 8-spoked wheel of Dhamma. The seeker of cod was transformed into a bodhisattva in search of awakening, guiding the boat of his precious human body by means of the Eightfold Path through the treacherous seas of samsara. According to the Ellis Island records, Leonard arrived in New York in 1913 at the age of 34. He worked as an actor in Boston's Copley Theatre during the First World War before taking up a career as a sculptor. He was easily recognized, this is a quote, by his prematurely white hair and ruddy complexion. He never remarried and appears to have lived alone. Judging from the dandyish poses in the photographs of him in the archives of the Cape Ann Historical Association, I wonder if he might have been gay. From the late 1920s, Leonard turned his attention to colour photography and was one of the first non-commercial photographers to work with colour film. He died in Boston in 1950, 2.5 years before I was born. "Money doesn't mean very much to me," he was quoted as saying in his obituary in the Boston Herald. "I do whatever I please, so I suppose I run counter to most people's patterns for a proper design of living. Personally, I think that most people are eccentrics and I'm not. People follow the herd. I don't, never have, never will." Like my great uncle Leonard, I am one of those people who has to make things. I become restless and irritable if I am not actively engaged in manufacturing something. Since 1995, I have been producing collages from discarded materials, paper, cloth, plastic, that I find dropped on the street, blown into hedgerows, tossed into waste baskets and dumpsters. Following strict formal rules, I cut up these useless, unwanted things with a scalpel and reassemble them as intricate, symmetrical mosaics. I have no idea why I do this. I have neither an aesthetic theory to prove nor any need for a product to sell. I am free to follow the silent intuitions that move me. I may spend months finding the right materials and organizing them into a collage. It is intensely satisfying to transform these scraps of waste into a composition that transcends each little piece, but could not exist without every one of them. I write books in this way too. Each book is a collage. Jackdaw-like, I pick and choose ideas, phrases, images, and vignettes that for some reason appeal to me. I am as likely to find them in a fragment of overheard conversation as in a Buddhist scripture. I do not work methodically. I sometimes discover what I am looking for by dreamily opening a book at random and stumbling across a sentence that jumps off the page as the answer to a question. Because I do not make systematic notes, I spend hours trying to retrieve a reference I have lost. Then I need to assemble all these little bits and pieces into tidily organized chapters, and I have to sustain the illusion of a self-assured narrator who has known from the outset what he wants to say and how he is going to say it. I experience the same tension between formal rules and arbitrary content as in making a collage. It reminds me of the opening quote that I chose to introduce the book. It's a citation by the filmmaker Wim Wenders, who says, "Stories are impossible, but it's impossible to live without them. That's the mess I'm in." And that captures better than I could find words for my own sense of what I'm trying to do in this book. It's an art project, if you wish, I must confess. Buddhism has become for me the raw materials of my art. In that sense, I'm an artist monkey, and have found in Buddhism very rich source of images, of stories, of ideas, of meditation practices that somehow enable me to engage in the creative, imaginative process which is comparable to that of producing art. So this it goes to the end of that, towards the end of that chapter, and I go back to the dilemma that faced the Buddha towards the end of his life. "I am living hemmed in by monks and nuns," thought Siddhartha Gautama to himself one day in the Gosita monastery near Kosambi, "by kings and ministers, by sectarian teachers and their followers, and I live in discomfort and not at ease. Suppose I were to live alone, secluded from the crowd." It's very interesting idea. I mean, the Buddha here is feeling hemmed in by his own community. "So after returning from his alms round, he tidied his hut, took his robe and bowl, and without informing anyone, set off unaccompanied for Parilayaka, where he stayed alone in a forest beneath a sal tree. Even the Buddha, it would appear, was oppressed by the organization he had created to uphold and spread his teaching. But if his ideas had not been organized into orthodoxies and institutions, would they have survived at all? However much I might sympathize with Ananda, the Buddha's sort of secretary, in his struggle with Mahakasapa, the former Brahmin who took control of the Buddha's order after the Buddha's death, I have to recognize that without the aggressive leadership of a man like Kasapa at such an unstable time, the Dhamma may have been forgotten within a generation or so of Gautama's death. If Sera Monastery, where I studied, in whose lineages I studied as a Tibetan monk, and Songwansa, the monastery I studied in Korea, had not existed for centuries as bastions of their respective Buddhist traditions, would I have been able to receive the kind of education and training that provided me a foundation on which to write about Buddhism as I do now? I very much doubt it. Whether I like it or not, the animating spirit of religious life and its formal organization appear like Buddha and Mara, to be inextricably entwined with each other. To reject organized religion in favor of a nebulous and eclectic spirituality is not a satisfactory solution either. As language users, we can no more cease trying to generate coherent theories and beliefs than a stomach can cease to digest food. As social animals, we invariably organize ourselves into groups and communities. Without a rigorous, self-critical discourse, one risks lapsing into pious platitudes and unexamined generalizations. And without some sort of social cohesion, one's brilliant ideas are liable to perish. The point is not to abandon all institutions and dogmas, but to find a way to live with them more ironically, to appreciate them for what they are, the play of the human mind in its endless quest for connection and meaning, rather than timeless entities that have to be ruthlessly defended or forcibly imposed. Religion today, says Don Cupid, he's an Anglican theologian I must admire, has to become beliefless. There is nothing out there to believe in or to hope for. Religion, therefore, has to become an immediate and deeply felt way of relating yourself to life in general and your own life in particular. This is the spirit in which I have tried to understand what the Buddha was saying all those years ago. In attempting to recover Gautama's humanity and disentangle his ideas from the prevailing opinions of his time, I like to think that a similar perspective may have animated him as well. Whether or not you find my resulting collage to be a convincing portrait of the man and his ideas, it is one that works better for me as a layman in today's world than any of the alternatives proposed by traditional Buddhism. So that's all I'm going to say. It's 9:15. Any comments or any questions, anything you'd like to raise, and I'll try and respond.
The question has to do with atheism, which I didn't hear you address in the readings too much, and just a general definition and why you would consider yourself an atheist.
Well, I did refer to it, actually quite a bit. I mean, I described the Buddha as being someone who rejected the ideas of a metaphysical God or self, theos, Atman Brahman, which is the theos in classical Brahminic thought, and instead turned his attention totally to a mindful attention of the phenomenal, changing, suffering world. So in that sense, the Buddha was quite definitely an atheist. Now, I feel that it's important to emphasize this and to use this term in the title of the book, because that is the spirit in which the book is written. Now, the two reasons I think this is helpful. One is to enter the debate which has occurred in recent years between the atheists, who are usually rather militant atheists, who have got a big axe to grind with God and think that people who believe in it are inherently stupid, and the fundamentalist, Christians, Muslims, or whatever, who are so convinced that only by believing in God can you have any meaning or purpose or value in your life, that this, I think Buddhism provides a middle way between these two extremes, between the anti-theism of the militants, of the Sam Harrises, the Richard Dawkins, the Christopher Hitchens, and so on, and the fundamentalist convictions of the theists. Buddhism is able to provide an atheistic spiritual practice and set and philosophy and morality that provides a quite sufficient foundation for leading what we would call a spiritual or religious life. And so I feel that Buddhism, I think, has a very important role to play in this dialogue. And yet, if you read the, apart from Sam Harris, who is actually a closet Buddhist meditator, but he flags that a little bit towards the end of his book. Both Dawkins actually says, well, actually, I'm not dealing with Buddhism here, that's something else, we'll put it to one side. So he doesn't even deal with the issue. And Hitchens makes some rather silly comments about, and he picks a few examples of where Buddhists have, you know, done rather ridiculous things, and includes them in the wastebasket of religion. But, and this was a great coup from the publisher's point of view, Christopher Hitchens wrote an endorsement of this book. You want to pass on that? Well, it's a funny story. I don't know Christopher Hitchens, but his editor at Vanity Fair is a fan of my books. And he came on a workshop I gave in New York last fall. And at the end of the workshop, as I mentioned, I'd written this book. He said, oh, I think Christopher might be interested in this. So I had my publisher send him and Christopher Hitchens a copy. And within 7 days, Christopher Hitchens had given an endorsement. And no, it's amazing. And also, he kind of backtracks on what he says in his own book. I'll read it. He says, the human thirst for the transcendent, the numinous, even the ecstatic, is too universal and too important to be entrusted to the cultish and the archaic and the superstitious. Now, that's unusual, because I don't remember in God Is Not Great Christopher Hitchens having any enthusiasm for the transcendent, the numinous, even the ecstatic. Now, the other reason I want to emphasize atheism is because I think Buddhism also has a tendency to slip back into theistic-like ideas. It doesn't talk about God, but many Buddhist teachers will start talking about the true nature of mind, or pristine awareness, or rigpa, or Buddha nature, or emptiness as the source of all things into which they out of which they arise and into which they fall. Or Buddhists will now talk a lot about, have always talked a lot about, the ultimate truth as opposed to the relative truth. And yet the Buddha never used that distinction once. So I think theism is not just a set of beliefs that belong to people who are overtly theistic, who believe in God. But theism, I think, is an instinctive human tendency to believe that there is something greater, something more than just this paltry existence on earth. And I think the belief in God is an extension of our instinctive belief that there is something at the heart of me that doesn't change, that won't die. And in the same way, I think God stands in the same relationship to the cosmos as the ego stands in relation to my body and mind. And I think it's a deeply intuitive idea, and that the Buddha quite deliberately said that his teaching went against that stream of ideas, of beliefs, of instincts, of intuitions. So these are the two reasons why I think atheism is important. It doesn't mean that I've stopped being an agnostic, which some of my readers have found to be upsetting because they like the agnostic thing. I think agnostic, atheist, humanist, secularist are all different facets of a non-theistic view. Yes?
So what about this question of transmigration or reincarnation of something with benefits or consequences of some sort?
Well, you see, I think that does almost invariably lead you into something like a belief in a soul. The Buddhists have great trouble with this because they say, well, there's no soul, no permanent soul, but if I swat a fly in this life, I will get zapped for it in a future life. Now, how does that work? If there is no, if the self or the person is an impermanent, fluid, contingent flux. So the Buddhists, the Buddha refused to address this question. He said, do not get into the question, do not consider whether the mind and the body are the same or different. He said that was a useless question. Yet every Buddhist school has basically opted for a body-mind dualism precisely to answer this question. So traditional Buddhism will posit some kind of consciousness. It'll usually be called a subtle consciousness. Subtle being code for, well, we don't really know what it is, but it has to exist. And consequently have slipped, I think, back into a sort of essentialism. Now, but you even find Saint Shantideva, who's the great 8th century Mahayana poet who wrote the Bodhicharyavatara. I mean, there's one passage in there where he says, it is one person who dies, it is another who is reborn. And for Shantideva, therefore, the only justification for being moral is compassion for the being who will be born from your acts, who is not you, who is as different from you as you are from me now. So you get hints in both early Buddhism and in some of these, and in Shantideva, which have a very different flavor to this idea that, you know, I will swap the fly now and I will get zapped in the future. Yeah?
I think there's some kind of truth available with the emergence of what we now know in genetics and genomics that doesn't require an identity moving forward, but something is moving forward. And in fact, when we think about what we now know about conception, sperm competition, the fact that it takes 3 days perhaps for fertility to occur after, you know, transfer. So it's like there's a way that could work into something, but it's not something that any of us ever really think about, most of us think about at all, really.
Well, no, that's true, and I think the Buddhist, that's a sort of argument that traditional Buddhism has used to justify its own theory of reincarnation as something that is processual but nonetheless retains a kind of a continuity. But the problem is that at physical death, the whole genetic structure of the body goes up in smoke. So you therefore have to posit something that is non-material, that survives physical death. That's the problem. It's very difficult to make sense of something that carries moral seeds, as they describe them, from the death of
one.
Isn't
that dualistic? Aren't you being dualistic yourself there? I mean, isn't there only one reality, and that our lives, the way we live our lives, everything has physical consequences?
No, I'm not being dualistic. What I'm saying is I reject the idea of a reincarnating entity. But I don't reject that the actions that we commit now will have effects beyond our death. So I accept karma, I reject reincarnation. And that, to me, I don't find that very difficult at all.
But can you have reincarnation without an integral self, an integral soul? That's not it.
Well, that, to me, is an academic question. It is a metaphysical question that the Buddha actually explicitly said, don't go there. Those sorts of questions are a huge distraction from what actually matters, namely our response to the suffering of the world. That's what matters. Forget about everything else. No, this is canonical. You may not accept it.
I can accept that, but that doesn't mean if the Buddha knew genetics that he wouldn't see a way to understand what he's talking about.
He might have done, and in fact, if you read Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese teacher, he interprets the idea of continuity from life to life in a genetic way. He says it's our children, it's future generations that will be reborn after our deaths, and our responsibility therefore has to be to them that our actions now, if we pollute this environment, other beings, our own offspring, the continuity of our own genetic matter, will suffer. That's, I think, probably the kind of way the Buddha would have seen it today. The difficulty, I feel, is this idea that there's some sort of spiritual entity that magically sort of hops from one life to another. Yes?
What about people who have
memories of their past lives? Well, that is the way to that's the sort of research that we have to pursue. Because there are kids, there's records of young kids, primarily in Sri Lanka and cultures that believe in rebirth, who make what appear to be quite convincing accounts or claims to having remembered their, you know, being died in a previous life. In other words, what the doctrine of rebirth is claiming is actually some kind of empirical truth. And if it is it's a truth claim about the nature of the human world we live in on this earth. So the way to pursue that is to investigate these cases. I completely agree with that, but the data we have so far is not convincing at all. There are all sorts of problems with it. It's suggestive, as Dr. Stevenson said, who did the initial research. It's suggestive of reincarnation. It's not proof. If empirical research continues to be done in this way of people who remember past lives, and if the scientific community and others have incontrovertible evidence that it does in fact work, then I'll accept it. I don't have a problem. But before there is that empirical evidence, I'm not willing to just because I'm a Buddhist, to buy into it. Yes.
It's a separate subject. I'm
good.
Curious about it. It's a question about whether I will be reborn. the question is your choice of the term confessions in the title.
Well, it's not confessions, it's confession.
Oh, it's just the one. Rather than a memoir, it's... speaking of religious traditions, obviously confession carries resonance from Catholicism.
Well, it does. And why I chose that term? Well, in the proposal for the book, it was confessions of a Buddhist atheist. But I changed that. Partly because the word confessions has become rather debased in our culture. Mm-hmm. If you go on Amazon, when I see my sales figures, I punch in confessions of Buddhism, and I get... Confessions of an Economic Hitman was a recent one. Confessions of a Shopaholic. Now, the great classical texts in our tradition in the West are the Confessions of St. Augustine. And this is one of my all-time favorite books. I don't know if you've read it. It's very easy to read. It's a beautiful tale. And it's written with passion, with commitment, and honesty and integrity. And I find it's a marvelous vehicle, literary vehicle, for communicating one's deepest passions and values and beliefs. And how those, in Augustine's case, of course, it's his conversion to Christianity that is told through his confessional narrative. And in writing this book, I was fully aware of doing so in the shadow of St. Augustine. In fact, I read St. Augustine's Confessions before I started working on this. The Confessions of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French Enlightenment thinker, but also works of, say, Michel de Montaigne, Blaise Pascal. It's in that tradition that I'm trying to write. But I know full well that I'm not, you know, remotely close to these great figures of our history. But that is the reason I chose the word confessions initially and then modified it to confession in the sense of a confession of faith. So it's not just I'm confessing only one thing, because I've only ever screwed up once in my life. It's only one misdeed. But because it is a confession of faith, a confession of what I most deeply believe in, expressed through my own narrative, the narrative of my own life. Yes, last question.
First of all, this is really great. I'm really glad I came tonight. I was looking at your book a little bit before we started. There was a little section about, you talked about if you reject the sort of supernatural aspects of Buddhism, like the reincarnation thing and the karma, much like, well, I have gone up against this with my religious friends, that I say I don't need God to feel like I'm a moral person, and they will say, but the whole point of God is to give people sort of the motivation or the threat that you'll get punishment or reward if you are a moral person. I don't feel like I have that. People have even said, well, that you were raised in a religious environment, maybe you got it from that. But you also talk about without the reincarnation and the karma, some Buddhists will say then it sort of undermines the whole point of, and you can't have morality without it. I've always felt like you can, but if we can, if that is true, where does it come from?
Well, I mean, this has been in the European Enlightenment of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. This was one of the great objections that the Catholic Church and the other Christian traditions had towards secularism, the secularism of the Enlightenment thinkers, is they said if you abandon the idea of God, you will abandon any basis for leading a moral life.
Right.
But, of course, it turned out not to be the case.
Right.
I mean, after the European Enlightenment, the world did not descend into a kind of chaos of immorality. And in fact, you have many examples, let's say in the Marxist tradition and others, in the utilitarian traditions, where you have a perfectly adequate basis for morality without having to evoke God. The other counter-argument to the Catholic Church is you have in the East Confucianists, Taoists, Buddhists, who've never even dreamt of the idea of God and yet have fully elaborated moral and ethical systems. So God is not necessary for morality. Now the Buddhists, the traditional Buddhists, the fundamentalist Buddhists, let's say, maintain that if you abandon karma and rebirth, you will not have a foundation for morality. Now this is exactly the same argument. And what it points to is belief in karma and rebirth, but particularly karma, is equivalent functionally to the belief in God. And you can illustrate this with a very simple example. Imagine that a couple have a child, and the child is, let's say, suffers from a severe learning disability or something. A traditional Christian will rationalize this by saying, we don't understand why our child is like this, but it must be the will of God. And that gives you a framework for then living lovingly and compassionately with the child. A Buddhist couple will say, we don't understand why our child has this problem, it must be his karma. So that gives them a framework for rationalizing and understanding something that is unintelligible and incomprehensible. But both approaches are equally problematic because they don't serve to motivate an inquiry into why does the child suffer from this disability. It's not going to be a very strong basis, God's will or karma, for actually trying to understand, let's say, the genetic origins of, say, certain disabilities. And so in other words, yes, both karma and God provide in pre-modern, pre-scientific societies a kind of a consoling strategy for rationalizing what's incomprehensible. But nowadays, I feel that the approach should be one of actually trying to find out what are, let's say, the genetic or the maybe social or other reasons that give rise to this suffering and seek to undermine those causes. That would surely be the Buddhist approach. So I think that we can live quite well, and I think there's so many examples of this that it seems a bit absurd to even maintain it, that you don't need this metaphysic to rationalize morality. Morality can be based upon your awareness of the suffering of the world and your commitment to understand what causes that. So Buddhist morality would be based really on trying to understand what thoughts, words and deeds cause suffering to myself and to others and what don't. And this is something that is again what you can begin to observe by paying attention to the quality of your acts, how you respond to others, how you live. And the Buddhist morality, I think, is based very much on that kind of premise.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.